It is 12:10 here on Thursday afternoon, just coming up on Christmas, the business lunch on 720 WG. And I'm Steve Bertrand. Thanks very much for tuning in. You know, everyone's sort of like easing into the holidays, I guess. Dennis Rodkin is here to talk about real estate. He writes for Cranes, and we'll kick around. I know there was a housing report that came out earlier this week, so that's ahead. We are going to talk about sort of the real estate of terminals, airport terminals in the country, and they're so upscale. They're not so comfortable for the average passenger. I don't know, are there trends there? Are there changes coming? We'll talk to a professor from Northern Illinois University about that. And a little bit later, why not organize your finances during the time between the holidays? Dennis is in the studio. You know, I was just telling you off the air that I've got nothing to do next week, and so I'm probably going to start working on my taxes. But I think it's like that time, you know, you get sort of energized at the end of the year, beginning of the year, to turn over some new leaves.
Well, I hope you managed to do that. I think there's a lot of talk of turning over new leaves. I hope you managed to,
You, on the other hand, will find a beach somewhere and have your feet up for the week.
Yeah, I'll sit a beach up on the North Shore and sit out on the ice and put my feet up.
I want to talk about the North Shore a little bit, some real estate there, but let's just talk in general, right? November was a good month when it comes to home sales in the area.
Really, when you look at the numbers, it was the strongest month for the Chicago area since March 2015. There are two measures, number of homes sold and median price. Mm-hmm. And for both the city and the larger region, both of those numbers were up. So we had both of those numbers were in the double digits. So we had four primary indicators that were all in the double digits. It's the first time that has happened since March 2015. Very strong numbers.
And it was up 16%, right, sales?
Yeah, and sales up.
Was that greater than the national number?
It is,
which,
yes.
That doesn't happen.
And what's interesting is that a lot of the big cities, especially in the West, have started to ease off. They're not dropping, but they're having lower growth than they were having. San Francisco, Portland, a few others, they're starting to see some easing. We tend to be almost a year, if not more sometimes, behind those cities, or right. We have in the past couple of years. So maybe we'll be sitting here a year from now saying, oh, it eased off. But yeah, November was really strong for the real estate market in the Chicago area.
And so I suppose that speaks to interest rates and fears of rising interest rates, or what is it that?
Well, it's hard to say that now because that's the number of homes sold, closed in November.
They would have started the action in October or September?
Yeah, those might be people who bought as early as August, depending on how long your closing time is. More likely late September, October. So we don't know that it's interest rates, although it is entirely possible. Everybody's been thinking interest rates would go up. Now, of course, we know that they will for sure. We've talked about how people were distracted by first the World Series run by the Cubs and then the presidential election.
Right.
But again, if you made your decision after the election, you haven't closed in November. There's also this scarcity problem. Inventory is so low, especially in the city, but also in many of the suburbs, that pushes up prices when there are fewer houses to buy.
So that's the price going up, but that doesn't speak to the volume.
It doesn't speak to the volume. One thing to keep in mind is that volume was way down. This is increases from pretty low volume sales. But even so, it is an improvement, and we hadn't been seeing improvement like that for most of the year.
So contracts were up big in November, which means they'll probably have more home sales closings coming up. But as far as entering into contracts for homes, we're in a downtime now, right? I mean,
We haven't been.
But you tell me about, and it picks up after the Super Bowl or something.
But well, usually it does. But we, in every week of November and into early December, the data is a little bit old, contracts for sales have been up, or homes that have gone under contract have been up considerably from the year before. That data is only for the city. I don't get data for the suburbs for that sort of thing. But it's widely believed that the suburban data will follow through, too. So we've had large numbers of closings of sold homes, large numbers of contracts going into the pipeline to be sold in the near future. So we could see some really positive numbers in the next few months.
So if you're a realtor, it's going to be a nice Christmas.
You know, the number of real estate agents, Steve, who have told me, I'm so busy right now, this is usually a really quiet time. They've been saying this to me really since the election.
Yeah.
This is usually a quiet time. This is usually a quiet time, but they're getting lots of foot traffic. They're putting things under contract. It's a real surprise.
All right, let's go to River Forest now. I teased with Pete about this house, I called it the first Frank Lloyd Wright designed home that he did on his own. Which is sort of right.
It's sort of right. It's the first one he did on his own for somebody else. He was designing his own home, and he was designing this one for a client essentially at the same time when he first left, when he first set up his own firm.
Left Louis Sullivan?
Yeah.
He was mid-20s, late-20s?
He's 24 years old when he designs this house, 24, and does a pretty beautiful piece of work.
And it... Now, did I read, too, that some of the ironwork on this house, is that right? Was done by the people who did the ironwork at the Carson?
Yeah, the client, the owner
of this house. At the Carson Peary Scott.
Right. Yeah. The home, the people for whom he designed this house, the man, was one of the brothers whose ironwork firm did Carson's and a whole lot of other buildings, but that's the best known. That's just a couple years after they've built this house.
All right, we're talking about the William Winslow House. It's on Auvergne Place and sold for 1.3 and change, which is really down from the original asking.
Yeah, it's $1 million off the original asking price. It took 3 years and $1 million in price cuts, which is pretty sad. It needs some updating. It's a really nice house. It's got some details. That ironwork is phenomenal. Yeah. When you walk up to this house, first of all, people shouldn't be picturing a Frank Lloyd Wright prairie-style house. Even though he described this as my first prairie-style house, it's one rectangular box as opposed to having the wings that come off or that jut off. And it's just this, I think, really beautiful piece with beautiful sand-colored brick below and some white terracotta and then this black iron trim around the top. It's a very simple, very elegant home with a lot of detail inside, but took quite a while to sell.
And it did finally, so there's that. And then let's go north to Glencoe as we follow the homes I'll never be able to afford.
Yeah, right. And this when you get your taxes in order, Steve.
Exactly. That's why I do it. The family sort of behind Alberto Culver.
Right.
The man is still alive, right?
The man is still alive.
His wife died.
Leonard and Bernice Lavin. She died a few years ago, and it's important to mention both of them because
I like this.
Yeah, because he was a sales rep in the 50s, traveling around the country, basically thinking, oh, maybe I'll buy this business, maybe I'll buy that. When he buys this hair care products company in LA, moves it here to Melrose Park, and he and she together build it into this enormous company, a market leader. And she really was an equal partner, if not the leading partner, for over 50 years.
And this goes back to the 50s, yeah.
Yeah, from 1955 forward. Bernice, what I read is that essentially she was management and he was marketing. And their marketing is what a lot of people remember. They were Alberto VO5. They had commercials like crazy when we were kids. But their management, clearly, is what made them into an enormous company, and she was it.
Which allowed them to afford a house with 300-foot frontage on Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And it's for sale now for a cool $8 million.
Cool $8 million, yeah. It's a really nice house. It, too, needs some updating. They had lived in it for several
decades. Dennis, we all need some updating.
Well, that's what I'm doing during
right.
the break.
Yeah. Right.
It needs some updating, but it's a very beautiful house. It's by Howard Van Doren Shaw, and it's got this big beach.
That's Dennis Rodkin. He writes about all of this at Cranes. You can read more at chicagobusiness.com. I want to take a break and come back. And he wrote a story. I want to talk to you about your story about the accessible home
and
the developer who's building a few projects around the city. That's coming up. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, one of my favorite guests. So listen, thanks for the great year. I really do appreciate it. I love when you come in.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. It's always fun to do it.
I have to do almost no work whatsoever. You always come with interesting stories and ideas. And one of them is this. So this developer is building a fully accessible home, right?
Yeah, really
Is it on the north side?
Yeah.
And she's got a few projects going. It's she, right?
It's a she, yeah.
It's a she, yeah.
Frances Cal.
And, but the thing, and I want to talk about the actual building, but what's interesting to me is she's kind of building these on spec.
Yeah.
You don't think of a fully accessible home as one being built on spec.
No, you don't. And there are a lot of people who do this sort of universal design thing because there are reasons we all ought to buy such a home.
Sure.
Because
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but it's my show. But when I was reading your story, I was thinking, didn't Naperville go really far out with some of their code requirements?
Bolingbrook and Naperville both have yeah.
Okay.
And it makes a lot of sense because even if I'm not permanently in a wheelchair, I may temporarily be injured and not be able to step over the rim of a bathtub, that sort of thing. And we're all going to age. So people have been talking about this for quite a while, and it's big in a lot of cities, but here Most of what we see built is custom. I'm disabled and I order up a home that works for me.
I'm disabled and now I need this home.
Yeah, and now I need this. And either build me something new that has all this stuff or retrofit my home with all the things it needs. And she's sort of passing that by and going straight to building it so that it is accessible and can be modified for further disability later.
And aesthetics. She's worried about the aesthetics.
And at the same time, yeah, what's cool about it is she wants them to be accessible but not look institutional. And to me, the best example is the toilet paper holder.
Right.
She talks about, you know, you become disabled or you move in or you are disabled and the toilet may be surrounded, like in senior citizen homes and things, surrounded by grab bars,
right,
which just looks...
Looks like, wow, I'm in one of those houses.
Yeah, now I live there. Right. So what she does is things like toilet paper holders, towel racks can be built to support a person's weight. The actual object can be, and then you mount it on a double braced wall so that rather than having to grab a bar to lower myself onto or lift myself from the toilet, I can just push on the
right,
toilet paper holder and grab the hand towel racks, which just keeps it from looking like an institutional place. And there are other touches throughout the building that she does that way to make it feel, as she says, more dignified, you know, just don't feel diminished.
Countertops on various levels. Right?
Countertops on various levels because it's...
An accessible, the door, wheel right in, no stairs going into the...
Yeah, which is... And what's interesting about that is you can do that anyway. There's no threshold. You don't have to bump up and down over... It, you know, some of those are like a half inch
sure,
high. But still, if I have mobility problems, that can be an obstacle. But that's also something that people do in modernist architecture is get rid of any excess
lines. Like a continuous floor.
Yeah. So
okay,
it works both ways for her.
So she's building this one. She's building some condos and rentals and...
Yeah, it's kind of, what I'm interested in is it's sort of an all-out approach. She's building a luxury home. That's the first that unwraps in January. So that's sort of what the news hook was, the reason I wrote about it now. She's also building some condos. And she's building a group of condos as well as a two flat, and she's also building some affordable rentals. And so, and they're all using these same principles.
Does she have a personal reason for this, or is it strictly
it's
looking
really
to the future?
And, yeah. She's a retired attorney. She's been involved in a lot of issues. She has seen people move their senior citizen parents in with them and have problems, or look for housing for them and have problems because, you know, how can I have a caretaker and also my own privacy? How can I get up over that the lip of the bathroom tub and things like that?
So she's forward thinking.
It's really a cool idea. She's a retired attorney looking to do something different and thought, let me try this.
Can she do it at the same cost that you and I would pay for a regular house?
As far as she has, she says that on this luxury home, you're only paying a small percentage more for the disabled things, but there also is one object she hasn't put in that would cost you about another $20,000, and that's a lift to get from between two spaces.
So lift aside, it's comparable,
yeah, and a lot of it is just thinking it out in advance. What's more expensive, she says, and experts told me as well, is retrofitting later, is taking a house, I've moved into my house and then I become disabled.
Right.
And I need to somehow put up the grab bars or brace the insides of the walls to put up those towel racks we were describing. And
lower the doorknobs and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's far less expensive, according to her, to build it first.
Dennis Rodkin, great to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
I'll see you next year. Have a great new year.
You too.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, Thursday, December 22nd, just a few days ahead of the Christmas holidays and New Year and all that. Are you traveling? Are you going to be in an airport or maybe two or maybe three? Mark Rosenbaum is a professor at Northern Illinois University. And I got some glare here. Mark, can I sit there? Can you hear me? Are you there?
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm great. I'm sorry. I'm sitting in the Showcase studio, the Allstate studio, which is beautiful, but sometimes the sun comes in, I can't see the button. So I'm glad I found yours. I'm doing well. My wife is a proud grad of Northern, so
wonderful.
Nice to talk to you on that front. And how is it that you became a student of airport concourses?
Well, I actually study customer experiences in shopping centers and in malls and in airports, and looking at how customers experience places that they're forced to gather in.
Right. And that's the case when it comes to airports. And, you know, Donald Trump is very fond of ripping the U.S. airports and the infrastructure and all of that. I know the LaGuardia he sees isn't the LaGuardia that I used to see. I used to travel back and forth from New York with some regularity. And it's just it's an astounding sort of whiff when it comes to passenger service there. Is LaGuardia typical of, I mean, then I think of Atlanta, which is so great. I mean, which is more representative of the airports in this country?
Well, actually, if we look at LaGuardia or even JFK, as well as Newark, we're seeing a lot of remodeling internally, but the airports aren't expanding. They simply don't have the land to expand. And because they don't have the land to expand and yet they need to remodel, they're actually encouraging retailers and restaurants and businesses within the airports to spend money on remodels.
So if the stores spend the money and the airports look better.
Exactly. But the airport operators are hiring certain restaurants, certain retailers to actually provide the remodels, which means we're going to start seeing, and you're seeing this in Newark, we're seeing dining options at the very high end. We're not talking about McDonald's. The days of McDonald's and food courts are long gone. We're seeing high-end, five-star dining options in airports. And this is a blessing and a curse.
Well, okay.
In terms of a customer experience.
Right. So let's go with the blessing. Well, I guess it's the blessing for the people who eat there. Who eats there?
Well, you're talking about high-end travelers. You're talking about business travelers who could expense it. But now think about the budget-conscious traveler. Think about the family traveling with four kids.
Right.
It's possible that lunch for four people will cost more than the airline ticket. And it's these options, these low-end options, are simply disappearing from airports.
And you're saying they're disappearing because the airports are bringing in high-end stores who can afford to renovate and make the place look better.
Right. Airport retailing is a little bit unique. So airport operators charge retailers a base.
Right.
But then after the retailer in the airport reaches a certain level, the airport operation receives a percentage of sales. So you can see how an airport organization has an incentive to bring in high-end luxury retailers, luxury restaurant and eating options. Simply, a higher bill means higher revenue for the airport.
But Mark, that's true, the higher individual bill, but you got to figure there are going to be fewer of those bills. I mean, I am never, I will tell you right now, ever going to buy a Rolex watch at an airport. I don't care how nice the airport is or how nice the watch is. It's not going to happen. So you would think they would make a sacrifice on volume.
But there are travelers who are buying. They're buying high-end shoes. They're buying Brooks Brothers. You're seeing this in the retailing options are actually increasing. Ann Taylor, Brooks Brothers are all found in airports. And, yes, I question who does this, but because you have so many passengers who must arrive 2 to 3 hours early, think about all the downtime the passengers have.
Right.
And I know this is hard for most people to conceive, especially for that budget traveler. Their experience is deteriorating. And not only that, because the airports aren't expanding in size, and yet the passenger numbers are increasing, airports are giving more and more internal space to restaurants and to retail options. So, in fact, there's less passenger space in the airports.
You know, and that's a good point, because I just want a place where I can relax a little bit, sit in a chair. I've always thought that, you know, coffee houses or a coffee house sort of stage, almost a little arena with people coming and going, would be a good idea. But I guess with what you're describing, that would take up so much real estate with no benefit for the airport manager that something like that would never happen.
Exactly. In fact, United has carved out at Newark the whole middle passenger access. Passengers used to have free access. The whole middle part is now restaurants, high-end restaurants. So we're going to see passenger discomfort, not just on the airplane, not just on the tarmac, but there will be less space for relaxation, less space to simply just chill out at the airport.
So while we're getting nickel and dime with bags and all of that stuff and overhead space, and now when we're in the airport, everything is going to be more expensive. There must be a saturation point where something's got to give, right? Or what's the future look like?
I think customers are going to learn. They're going to learn how to deal with this. They're going to learn that there are not affordable options, which means they'll probably bring their own food to the airports, causing a backlash. I mean, the customers will learn how to save some money, especially those with families and small children.
Right.
There's going to be a backlash as the airline passenger experience kind of deteriorates for that budget traveler. The high-income traveler, the business traveler, of course, will relish all of these new retail options.
Are the business travelers out there? Are the business travelers out there? I mean, I know after 2008, you know, the companies had cut back a lot on that. Have they returned?
The numbers are still strong for business travelers. I mean, okay. They're the ones who are clearly expensing lunch. And again, these high-end options benefit the airports because it's a source of revenue.
You know, I'm sorry, it's a weird parallel, but in a way, it's like it's the way business and companies are pricing families out of the ballpark. You know, so many people there are going to skyboxes or they're all corporate seats that everything's become so expensive the regular guy can't really go, and now he can't even get a hot dog at the airport.
Exactly. When we talk about the flyer experience, I think some people will enjoy it, but I think the vast majority of the budget travelers and those traveling with small kids, they're going to be outpriced.
Okay, so the airline headline of the day, Mark, I don't know if you saw this. I'm talking to Mark Rosenbaum. He's a professor at Northern Illinois University. Ivanka Trump was flying with her family, I guess, to Hawaii for a break, and this happens now. Some guy was very rude on the plane and started yelling at her, which I think is the headline for most people. For me, it said she was flying JetBlue. How can that be?
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, everyone seeks value.
Even the Trumps.
Including the Trumps.
Mark Rosenbaum, the professor, NIU professor of marketing. Thanks very much for joining us today. Have a great holiday.
Thank you, too.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Nancy Doyle is in the studio. She has a book out called Manage Your Financial Life, subtitle A Thoughtful, Organized Approach. Now, the last two words, Nancy, are for women. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm here to argue for you, though, that it doesn't have to be just for women, because I think this is the sort of stuff that all of us should be paying attention to.
That's true. It does. Book really applies to both men and women, but for many reasons, I decided to write it for women.
Because they're smart enough to read up on it.
They are. That's true.
And so we're talking a little bit off the air because, and this has happened in my lifetime and yours as well, in that we have been given so much more, so many more opportunities to invest and to save and to control how those work. And it's good and bad, right? I mean, pensions are gone, but 401ks are here. So we've got control over how that's invested and all of that. The downside is if we don't pay attention to it, that we individually suffer for it. And the other downside, I think, is it's just too much sometimes. You know, I've got the health savings account here and the SEP IRA there and the, you know, four or five different student loans in different directions. And it's really, for as empowering as it can be overwhelming as well.
That's true. And the book is really lays out my approach, and there's four steps to the approach, and I recommend that women or men, if they'd like to read it, follow all four steps. And it starts with getting organized. As you say, we are inundated not only with the accounts, the choices, but also with information, whether it comes in your mailbox or your inbox,
right,
both electronic and paper files. So I recommend that everyone start with getting organized, then analyze your financial profile, educate yourself about investing, and the last step is putting your money to work, or actually investing your money.
And so when it comes to getting organized, I mean, well, I think I know where everything is. Actually, you know, my wife Sharon handles a lot of it, most of it now. But, you know, we think we have it all, but it just seems like things can slip by because it's like, you know, there's the big things. There's the 401k and like, well, this is, I got to pay attention. But it's the little nickel and dime things that you lose track of.
That's true. And I start the book recommending that people do what I call is a financial spring cleaning. You don't have to do it in the spring.
Yeah.
It's actually a great thing to do at the start of the year. And just like if you go through your closet and decide what to keep, what to donate, what needs repairs, you gather up all the financial information you have in your house, all your essential legal documents, your wills, credit card accounts, accounts, bank statements, put everything in one room, and then you start to sort. You have to figure out what to keep, what to shred, what to recycle, and then you have to come up with a system for how to maintain it going forward.
The I was joking earlier, but really sometimes if you're not working, and I'm not next week, the week between the holidays is one of those times when you are kind of energized to renew, to get started. And that's why I thought it'd be nice to talk to you now, because that could be a good time to sort of take advantage of all this.
Well, I also think, too, when you go through your financial spring cleaning, you'll be so surprised to find how much information you don't need to keep. And by keeping information that you don't need, you can't find what you really do need.
I'm laughing because in my house, I thought we were going to clean the basement, you know, and really a lot of it's mine. And I was going through this old file cabinet, and I have saved my electric bills, phone bills, and everything. No kidding, from my bachelor days in the late 80s and early 90s, I would keep, I can remember 2000, I would keep a box for every year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason for me to have that now.
No.
Except for nostalgia, right? Do you have to be kind of weird to go through your old electric bills?
No, I still have, as I write in the book, I still have my first passbook savings account from when
go.
I was 9 years old.
Right.
I still have the little book. I saved it.
What do you think is the biggest mistake people, let's turn that around. Mm-hmm. Rather than mistake, what do you think is the one thing that if people are going to start the new year and sort of renew all of this, the one step they should take?
Well, clearly the financial spring cleaning. And the other thing I discuss in the get organized part is preparing an ICE plan and an ICE file. And that's where you get together the most important documents, the essential documents, your will, your powers of attorney. And you also make a list of all your various financial accounts and the contact information. Having it in one place really is helpful, but in the event of emergency,
right,
it really makes a big difference.
Two things: it helps people who might look for it in your absence.
Exactly.
But in your time of stress, too, it's good to know that it's there and you know where it is.
And also, if you think about it, during times of stress, somebody may need to access your accounts for you.
Right.
And with privacy laws the way they are, that can be difficult.
Nancy Doyle, the name of the book, Manage Your Financial Life. It's nice to meet you. Hope you come back.
Yes, thanks so much. And I hope that people will pick up a copy of my book. It's a great way to start the new year. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent bookstores. And you can also come to my website, which is manageyourfinanciallife.com.
Great. Thanks, Nancy.
Thanks so much, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Going to wrap it up for the Business Lunch on this Thursday afternoon. Big thanks to Jasmine Cooper, who was producing, filling in for Michael Heideman today.